Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm David Epstein, a reporter at ProPublica, and I'm here with Evan Ratliff, the co-founder of Atavist magazine, a host of the popular long-form podcast, and an investigative reporter and the author of a series that's coming out in serial form called The Mastermind, which is, to me, about a guy who very well could have ended up being Mark Zuckerberg, but instead ended up being an organized crime mastermind. And before I let Evan talk, this story is both an amazing story in its own right, but for anyone who's interested in how investigative reporting works, it lays a lot of the process on the table. And so just bear with me because I want to read a section of one of the installments that I think is pretty tantalizing and gives a little insight and is better summary of the story than I can give. So, for a man who built an empire in pixels, Paul LaRue seemed like a digital phantom. After his name surfaced in the press in late 2014, I spent the better part of a year trying to understand him through the same means by which he'd directed his massive pharmacy business, the internet. Late at night, I would open my laptop and plunge into an online wormhole, searching for clues about who LaRue had been and what he became. There I found another Paul LaRue, from another time, one who'd left his trace in archived copies of long-dormant websites and message boards. This LaRue had been famous among a small community of hackers and privacy geeks in the early 2000s, as the author of an important piece of encryption software. Before encryption was a mainstream idea, before Apple defied a U.S. government request to provide a method to unlock our phones, this LaRue had written the underlying code of a program that, a decade and a half later, the National Security Agency still could not break. The question was, could the LaRue who politely answered jargon-laden posts about encryption software be the same one who ordered the murder of a real estate agent over a bad deal on a beach house? At first, I thought I would never know. The former Paul LaRue seemed to have disappeared from the internet in 2004. Encryption experts I contacted had no idea what had become of that LaRue, and there was no evidence linking him to the man known for drugs and gun running. One night in October, I'd been at the computer for hours when I finally found the missing link. It was a website once registered to the Encryption LaRue in the early 2000s, and later transferred to a Philippine company controlled by the crime boss LaRue. My immediate reaction upon discovering this connection was a sudden and irrational fear. LaRue was something new, a self-made cartel boss whose origins were not in family connections but in code. Not just any code, but encryption software that would play a role in world events a dozen years after he created it. So I thought that was a beautiful encapsulation of parts of the story and also testament to how difficult it is to track someone who's in organized crime. So maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but to start where that leaves out, can you tell us about what world events a dozen years after Paul LaRue created the encryption software you're alluding to there?
I can. There's actually some world events that are in the story and then other world events that I didn't even know about until a week after the story came out. So what's referenced in the story is that, so Paul LaRue, when he was working on encryption software in the late 90s and early 2000s, he created the software called Encryption for the Masses, E4M, which in and of itself is not widely known, but it became the basis for a piece of software called TrueCrypt. And TrueCrypt has been the standard for disk encryption, meaning if you want to encrypt files on your laptop or a flash drive, for over a decade, TrueCrypt was one of the best ways to do it. And so some anonymous developers took Paul LaRue's original code for encryption for the masses. They created TrueCrypt. Now, fast forward to 2012, 2013, Edward Snowden, right before he left Hawaii, right as he was in contact with Glenn Greenwald and other journalists, he threw a crypto party in Hawaii.
Sounds rocking.
Yeah, actually, I like crypto issues, so the idea of like a bunch of people sitting around talking about them actually sounded like pretty fascinating. I've never been to one, but the idea of the crypto party was that you would explain to people who might not know how to use certain encryption software how to use it, and Snowden's presentation was on TrueCrypt and how to use it and how important it was, and then even later, when they were sifting through the information that he delivered, there's an article in Der Spiegel from 2014 that there is a document in those files that shows that the NSA could never break TrueCrypt, or at least that it was very troublesome for them to try and break files of TrueCrypt. So TrueCrypt became this thing that is very important. And then, unbeknownst to me, this week, actually, the New York Times reported that ISIS has also been using TrueCrypt. So TrueCrypt has a long and interesting history in and of itself, but it's now playing a role in all of these issues.
That's amazing. And the fact that it came from this guy, I mean, one of the amazing things in reading the story is like the number of countries that get connected. I mean, this is old school organized crime in certain ways, like goofballs filing their expenses after they do assassinations, right, like as if it's a normal job, but new in the sense that it involves internet e-commerce, multiple countries, obviously a guy who helped build some software that's affected our lives maybe more than any software other than iTunes, or maybe more than that in a lot of ways. And while I was reading it, I've done some complicated investigative reporting myself.
I was like,
holy crap, the amount of information you had to organize over years is daunting. And so to now go backward a little bit, I want to know how this even first came onto your radar. How do you even start deciding to file away information on this in the first place?
Well, at first, you know, I didn't pursue it. I pursued it a little bit, but the way I found out about it was the way probably a lot of different reporters found out about a piece of the story, which was that a guy named Joseph Hunter was arrested in 2013 in this sort of very weird plot to kill a DEA agent in Liberia. So he had engaged in this plot and hired all these guys to kill this DEA agent and like a snitch for a drug cartel.
And he himself had been a soldier, right?
He was a U.S. soldier. He's American. He had been in the Special Forces briefly. He was a trainer. He's actually comes up in a later episode. We haven't written about him in depth yet, but that story made the news. One of the reasons it made the news is that his literal nickname was Rambo. So his name was like Joseph Rambo Hunter, and it made for incredible headlines. It was in the Times. It was in Vice. It was in international newspapers. I was intrigued. I'm sure a lot of reporters were intrigued. And I dug into it a little bit, and there was a connection between that and another case that had just come up about meth dealing out of North Korea, like meth shipments out of North Korea. And you could sort of tell they were connected, and a couple of other reporters also made that connection. But it was hard to tell how they were connected. And so I was just doing, over the course of really like 2 years almost, computer reporting. Like I was just sitting at my computer as described in that passage and just kind of putting in names and trying to figure out how they were connected. And then the big break was actually a reporter at the Times named Alan Fuhrer actually revealed LaRue's name. So LaRue was the connective tissue of these cases that no one could see. And when he revealed that, then I thought, well, there's a much bigger story than just the fact of Paul LaRue. Like, there's the history of Paul LaRue. And I started digging into it. And what really hooked me was the encryption, the fact that there was this encryption connection, that he wasn't just a criminal, although it was a very interesting criminal of his own right. It was that he came at it in this different way, that he came at it from being a programmer.
You alluded to kind of seeing little tidbits in the news and having these hunches that there's something more there. If I recall, the whole saga kind of starts, or very early on, you portray a murder in the Philippines of seemingly mild manner real estate agent. Like, why would this happen? And you're going over into the Philippines, and it seemed like you followed your hunches. There's a time when you ask openly in the story, you say, why would somebody have paid whatever $70,000 it is for two Americans to go to the Philippines to murder a woman who's a real estate agent there? Because it seems like your curiosity led you on, even when there wasn't necessarily, you didn't really know what was going to come out. There's a lot of unknowns, and you kept following your hunches. Can you talk about that, you know, learning about that story?
Well, at first, there was a part in Joseph Hunter's indictment where it just said, and I should say that it was very secretive. Like, a lot of aspects of his case and cases connected to him were held in extreme secrecy. All the files were sealed. The indictment was sealed for a while. Different filings would go in and have to be redacted and sealed. And it was all a little bit mysterious why it was so tightly held. And there was this line in his indictment that said, by the way, he also was responsible for the death of two real estate agents. And I spent a really long time trying to figure out who these people were. Like, I didn't even know what country it was. So I was looking for like real estate murders in India, real estate murders. And I came up with all these. You're surprised to find like a lot of real estate agents are murdered, sadly. So I was trying to figure out who these
people
totally
were. Doesn't totally surprise me, having looked around at New York real estate, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know if it's out of anger generally, but then it just so happened that these two Americans were indicted for the crime of killing a real estate agent in the Philippines. And that, even in that, it didn't say who it was. And so myself and a researcher that I've been working with had to figure out who is this person. And it was such an absurd idea. Like, the idea that someone who's worth potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for some reason is killing a real estate agent and having Americans do it. It just didn't make sense. Like, there had to be something bigger. Either there had to be something bigger there, or this person was absolutely ruthless in a way that shocked me. And I think that's what led me to that particular story as sort of like my way in. That was when I decided to go to the Philippines. It was really to trace that particular murder.
It's interesting to me because sometimes I think the difference between most of the stories that are reported in the press in general and the ones that turn into like these epic couldn't make it up in Hollywood kind of sagas, the difference between someone thinking like, ah, there might be these two things are connected, and someone feeling strongly enough about that to try to figure out how they're connected. Yeah, I mean, it connects an amazing number of crimes across countries. You mentioned going to the Philippines, and I think when you went to the Philippines to look into the murder of, I think her name was Christine Lee, the real estate agent, you write at a point in the story, you're sitting, I guess, in a police department in the Philippines, basically say, I asked if I could look at the case file for the murder, and to my surprise, Del Monte, the officer, handed it to me, which is an amazing moment, right? Because I guess that's one of the things you should always ask for documents that you don't think you're going to get, right? And I had to smile at some of the documents in this. Like, there's one photo of Paul LaRue. It's like the only known public photo. And then in the story, there are others that's like, the credit is like first time this photo's ever been published.
Yeah.
Right? It's an international crime boss. But can you describe what you saw in that file when he handed it over to you?
Yeah, well, that file, the funny thing is I'd had that experience in a previous story that made me understand that different countries have different standards. Like, the DEA still will not talk to me. The U.S. Attorney's Office still will not talk to me about this story. We're four episodes in, and it's an open case, so generally they won't talk about open cases. But when you go to other countries, they have different standards, and different police have different understanding of those standards. So I sort of made it my policy to always just ask the question that seems impossible. And that was actually, we were riding in a van, and we had gone out to the crime scene because they just wanted to look at the crime scene. And then they had taken the file with them. And then on the way back, I was just sort of sitting in the back of the van and said, hey, can I see that? Can I look at that? And then was paging through it and taking pictures of it with my iPhone. And in that file was the details of this woman, Christina Catherine Lee's murder and the autopsy and all that. But there was also a couple of Xeroxed pages of a visit from the US DEA and a representative from the US Embassy was also listed in there. So they're actually photocopies of their business cards and notes from the conversation that they had had. And at the bottom of that was a note written that said, Hunter ordered, which is Joseph Hunter was the original person whose case had gotten me interested in it. And I knew already that there was a connection to Hunter. It was in his indictment. But the fact of like the police handing me a file that has their handwritten notes from what the DEA has told them about the case was just, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I think it's a good lesson for reporters too. Sometimes I think the longer we're in the business, the more we start to adhere to like the protocols of people we ask questions of, and they make you feel bad if you ask things you're not supposed to have, but like that's their job to make you feel bad, but we should still ask. And so you're looking at this file and starting to get an idea that something's bigger, right? Because American agents are interested in it. There's an interesting scene where you're talking to the investigator in the Philippines, Del Monte, and you're starting to have a hunch about a connection in these cases. He seems to be fearful, right? He doesn't want to say certain things. Can you describe that scene and how, as a reporter, you worked through that?
That's a different agent. So the ones who gave me the file were actually local police.
Okay.
They're Philippine National Police, but they're the local police for that area. And then I went to what's called the NBI, the National Bureau of Investigation, which is the equivalent of our FBI, essentially. So they sort of take cases when they get bigger, or sometimes if the family doesn't think that the local cops are really investigating it because there's a lot of corruption, they'll go to the NBI and ask them because they're known to have a better reputation for integrity. So this was this agent named Zaldi Rivera at the NBI. He had taken on this Catherine Lee case, and he had also talked to the DEA, so he also knew about the American connection and all these things. And so he knew who was ultimately behind it. And we had this kind of back and forth where he kept calling him the mastermind. And he would say, yes, the mastermind did a real estate deal with Catherine Lee, and the real estate deal fell apart for various reasons, and the mastermind this and the mastermind that. And I finally said, well, do you know who the mastermind is? And he said, well, I can confirm. And I said, okay, if I say it, will you confirm? And he said, yes. And then I said the name. Even then, he kind of hemmed and hawed for a second. And then he sort of like lowered his voice and said, it's Paul LaRue. You know, he's the one. So it was the first moment that I had sat with someone who said, yes, like Paul LaRue is the person we're talking about here. He is the person that connects all of these crimes and all of these networks together. It's him.
And so I sort of gave a little bit of a description of what I thought about Paul LaRue at the beginning, but can you describe, I guess, in a nutshell, a picture of him sort of emerges over the installments. And installment three of the story is when really a full picture of his whole life from childhood emerges. But can you sort of describe, put him in a nutshell, I guess, how you think of him now?
He was born in Zimbabwe, or it was called Rhodesia at the time, later moved to South Africa, grew up in South Africa, dropped out of high school. And he's, in some ways, a classic sort of self-taught programmer. He got his first computer and then never wanted to leave his room, according to one of his relatives. He was always trying to figure out new programs to write. And then he set off from South Africa and lived in different parts of the world. He clearly had a kind of wanderlust, and he lived in the United States, actually. No one knows exactly what he did when he was in the United States. He lived in the UK, and then he moved to Australia and got married. And at first, he was very active in message boards. So I was able to find like a lot of his history of a certain period from these Usenet boards that are actually archived online by Google. So if you know the email addresses and the handles of people, you can kind of find their history. And he was on the one hand, a kind of like online troll. Like he was always winding people up and saying these crazy things. On the other hand, he was talking about encryption software and how he was writing encryption software. And then he went from encryption software to creating an online pharmacy, and he turned that online pharmacy business into at least $100 million business. Some people speculate much more. Some of his employees speculate that he was a billionaire. The numbers are all over the place. There's no way to know.
I think one guy said he saw $100 million in cash in his office.
Right? Yes. And we had a funny like fact-checking back and forth with him where, you know,
what does $100 million look like?
Exactly. And I actually found this visualization online of what $100 million looks like. And it's like made into a couch with a person sitting on it.
Nice.
And I sent it to him and I was like, is this the amount of money you saw? And he was like, that's not an unreasonable portrayal of how much I saw.
That's amazing. And one of the most fascinating things I thought about, again, leading up to part three, where it's sort of you're picking off pieces of this guy's story, and then all of a sudden there's a full portrait of him in a way that, you know, here's a criminal who's potentially as or more important than guys like Chapo Guzman, who, you know, everybody's heard of because he's escaped from his showers and several times, and or the guy who's Victor
Boot,
okay, yeah. who's portrayed by Nicolas Cage in Lord of War, I think it is. And yet, nobody's really heard of him. And to my knowledge, I've never read a more thorough nonfiction account of the progression from childhood of a crime boss to that level. And there's an amazing moment in the story where you have this breakthrough. You've been keeping up with this for years in one way or another. And then I'm reading this story where you say, 2 weeks ago, I get this tip. And so we're almost like following your reporting in real time. And can you describe what that tip was? Because from there, the story is like just you can't stop reading after that. That point's amazing.
We decided to do the story serially. And this was one reason. This was sort of what we were hoping for. We were hoping that as a couple of episodes came out, more people would come out of the woodwork. Because it's really, really hard to get people to talk about working for a criminal he's killed people who have worked for him for various reasons. People are legitimately afraid for their lives if they speak out. So I had found a lot of sources, but I was sort of hoping to get more. And as it happened, after the first episode came out, this person who is a relative of his sent me an email. And at first I kind of glossed over it because it just sort of said, great story, you know, I'm really enjoying the story. And then it said something like, did you know he also had a Bulgarian passport and a diplomatic passport from the Congo? And then I was like, how does this person know that? Clearly they know something, but it was very casual almost. And so I emailed that person back, and actually there was something in the anonymous email that they sent me that kind of made me think it was someone I had contacted before. And I did contact that person again, who sort of said, yeah, that's me, but let's keep it in the anonymous email. And then we started chatting. So I called this person Lulu, and that's the handle that they used when we've been chatting. But it's a relative of LaRue's who knows a lot, both about how he grew up, but also worked for him in his organization at one point. So this is someone who had a full picture up to a point of what LaRue was doing. So to me, it felt like it was like luck mixed with like the story getting out. That's one of the nice things about putting it out in sequence like this is we can try to catch up to reporting that still, this morning I got an email from someone who knew Paul or his wife. So, you know, there's sort of all sorts of things that come in when you kind of put out the word.
So once Paul, you mentioned some of his enterprises, one of which is basically a pill mill online operation. Well, I guess one of his great connections there is to this like elderly gentleman in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, who's running a pharmacy. Can you describe a little bit about that connection? Because that like brings him into the United States in a way that really hits home, I think, in
the
story.
Yeah, the network that they set up, the pill mill, the online prescription drug operation, was kind of genius because there's lots of these things out there. They've been happening for decades or more where there's Canadian pharmacies and Indian pharmacies and all this sort of thing. And their scheme was that they would recruit doctors and pharmacists in the United States to both create the prescriptions and deliver the pills themselves. So if you logged on to one of their sites, you filled out a questionnaire. That questionnaire went to an American doctor who had been recruited into their network, who then looked at the questionnaire or possibly didn't even look at the questionnaire, wrote a prescription. That prescription in the system that Paul LaRue created then was transferred to a pharmacy with no relationship to that doctor. That pharmacy took the prescription, filled it, and sent it out via FedEx using a FedEx number that they had been provided by the network. So they targeted pharmacists, particularly like this guy, Charles Schultz, who he ran, it's basically a family business. And he had two pharmacies in Wisconsin. One of them was in Oshkosh and one of them was in Monroe. He was struggling financially because big box pharmacies had sprung up all over the place. And he gets this, in his case, a fax from a company he's never heard of that says, hey, if you fill these prescriptions, you'll get, you know, $3.50 or $4 fee on each one. Thinks about it. At first, he knows there's something maybe shady about it. And he even asks them, you know, some version of like, is this legal? And they put him on the phone with a guy they say is an ex-DEA agent in Florida who says, no, it's all good. None of these are controlled substances. Plus, he's got prescriptions. He's getting real prescriptions by real doctors. So he says, okay. He starts doing it. He ends up doing tens of thousands of them and making, you know, he's got millions of dollars coming into his accounts and eventually tens of millions from Hong Kong being transferred into his accounts. And it's floating his business. So, you know, on the one hand, morally, you could definitely judge him. And criminally, he eventually took a plea, and but he didn't have to serve jail time and cooperated with the DEA. But, you know, you can understand how someone gets caught up in something like that. That it feels like there's a moral edge there that they're crossing, but they just don't quite stop themselves.
Gotcha. And before I let you go, I want to ask you one separate question, because having done not so long ago a cartel story and having the experience of being like in Tijuana and people not wanting to say the name of the Arellano Felix family I was reporting about, you know, when I'm here, I feel like, well, nobody wants to do anything. It would be a bad idea for criminals to kill me or something when I'm in America. But when I'm there, I did start to get the feeling of, okay, I'm asking about people whose name often isn't uttered. How much would it cost to find some guy, you know, with a gun to get rid of me? Probably not that much. So I got the question a lot, was I scared? And try not to think about it when I'm doing my job, but I want to ask you that question too, because you were obviously in a lot of different countries, some of which I'm sure you could disappear and nobody would hear from you again.
Yeah, I think first I try not to overplay that even in my own mind, because you can get really paranoid if you do that. And I'm not a war reporter and I'm not generally in, you know, dangerous environments or anything like that. So here, I generally think people who are involved in this thing, they've got all kinds of problems with each other. Like, and some of them might be mad about some of them talking. Some of them might be mad about things that happened. But my role in it is not one that they are going to benefit from harming me. No one really benefits from that. I mean, they could say, like, stop me from publishing it, but I don't think that's their biggest concern in most of these cases. Like, some of them are concerned about going to prison for life, and some of them are concerned about being arrested, especially because the story is already out now, or parts of the story are already out now. There would be no point in that. But I think when I'm in a local place, I did get somewhat paranoid in the Philippines because it's just very hard to tell who to trust. And you talk to one person, and then you talk to another person, and you realize that the person before was scheming you. And that can create a lot of concern. But again, I was working with a local reporter, and I'm much more concerned about the local reporter because the local reporter has to stay.
Right.
You know, I go home. And so we were pretty careful to not put that reporter in situations where that would come back on them later. So if there were things that seemed very sensitive, someone that I was meeting with who was totally anonymous and clearly worked for LaRue, I would meet with that person by myself. But again, like, I don't think there's anything in it for them. That's hopefully I'll never be proven wrong. But in these sorts of stories, I think there's not an advantage to someone to like doing harm to the reporter. They cannot talk.
That's how I generally feel about it. And then my hope is just that other people are thinking of the cost benefit the way that I am.
Right. Which I guess if you look at some of these cartels, they're not always thinking in that rational fashion. But
thank you very much, Evan. And again, I want to say we've been here with Evan Ratliff. I'm David Epstein, reporter at ProPublica. Evan is the co-founder of the Atavist magazine, host of the Long Form podcast, and the author of the mesmerizing series, The Mastermind. I think part four is out last week. It's a scintillating read, and it's unfolding basically in real time. And you rarely get to read an investigative series unfolding in real time. So I highly recommend it, both for the insight into how investigative reporting works, but also just the drama of the story itself. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We'll be back next week.